associated with the more Keynesian Democratic Party, such as Lawrence Summers, who led the charge for financial deregulation. France's socialist technocrats appear to have concluded from the failed Mitterrand experiment with Keynesianism in the early 1980s that domestic economic management was no longer possible and that there was no real alternative to financial globalization. The best that could be done was to enact Europe-wide and global rules instead of allowing powerful countries like Germany or the United States to impose their own. The good news is that the intellectual vacuum on the left is being filled, and there is no longer any reason to believe in the tyranny of no alternatives. Politicians on the left have less and less reason not to draw on respectable academic firepower in economics. Consider just a few examples. Anat Admati and Simon Johnson have advocated radical banking reforms that would prevent the problem of too big to fail. Thomas Piketty and Tony Atkinson have proposed a rich menu of policies to deal with inequality at the national level, including the taxation of wealth and rules that would make technological innovation more worker-friendly. Mariana Mazzucato and Ha Jun Chang have written insightfully on how to deploy the public sector to foster inclusive innovation. Brad DeLong, Jeffrey Sachs, and Lawrence Summers, the very same, have argued for long-term public investments in infrastructure and the green economy. Joseph Stiglitz and Jose Antonio Ocampo have proposed reforms for the global economy to enhance the influence of developing nations, which complement the proposals in this book. There are enough elements here for building a programmatic economic response from the left. A crucial difference between the right and the left is that the right thrives on deepening divisions in society, us versus them, while the left, when successful, overcomes these cleavages through reforms that bridge them. Hence, the paradox that earlier waves of reform from the left, Keynesianism, social democracy, and the welfare state, both saved capitalism from itself and effectively rendered themselves superfluous. Absent such a response again, the field will be left wide open for populists and far-right groups to make further gains. They will lead the world, as they always have, to deeper division and more frequent conflict. The Politics of Anger. History never quite repeats itself, but its lessons are important nonetheless. We should recall that the first era of globalization, which reached its peak in the decades before the First World War, eventually produced an even more severe political backlash. In the heyday of the gold standard, Jeffrey Frieden argues, mainstream political actors had to downplay social reform and national identity because they gave priority to international economic ties. The response took one of two fatal forms in the interwar period. Socialists and communists chose social reform, while fascists chose national assertion. Both paths led away from globalization to economic closure, and far worse. Today's backlash will most likely not go quite so far. As costly as they have been, the dislocations of the Great Recession and the Euro crisis pale in significance compared to those of the Great Depression. Advanced democracies have built and retain, despite recent setbacks, extensive social safety nets in the form of unemployment insurance, retirement pensions, and family benefits. The world economy now has functional international institutions, such as the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization, that it lacked prior to the Second World War. Global value chains have entrenched strong business lobbies for continued integration that even an instinctive protectionist like Donald Trump will find hard to overcome. Last but not least, truly extremist political movements such as fascism and communism have been largely discredited. Still, the conflicts between a hyper-globalized economy and social cohesion are real, and mainstream political elites ignore them at their peril. The internationalization of markets for goods, services, and capital drives a wedge between the cosmopolitan, professional, skilled groups that are able to take advantage of it, and the rest of society. An identity cleavage revolving around nationhood, ethnicity, or religion, and an income cleavage revolving around social class. populists derive their appeal from one or the other of these cleavages. Right-wing populists, such as Trump, engage in identity politics. Left-wing populists, such as Bernie Sanders, emphasize the gulf between the rich and the poor. In both cases, there is a clear other toward which anger can be directed. You can barely make ends meet. It is the Chinese who have been stealing your jobs. Upset by crime, it is the Mexicans and other immigrants who bring their gang warfare into the country. Terrorism? Why, Muslims, of course. Political corruption. What do you expect when the big banks are bankrolling our political system? Unlike mainstream political elites, populists can easily point to the culprits responsible for the masses' ills. Of course, establishment politicians are compromised because they have been at the helm all this time, but they are also immobilized by their central narrative, which smacks of inaction and helplessness. This narrative puts the blame for stagnant wages and rising inequality on technological forces beyond our control. It treats globalization and the rules that sustain it as inexorable and inevitable. The remedy it offers, investment in education and skills, promises few immediate rewards and would bear fruit years from now, at best. In reality, today's world economy is the product of explicit decisions that governments have made in the past. It was a choice not to stop the general agreement on tariffs and trade and to build the much more ambitious and intrusive WTO. Similarly, it will be a choice in the future whether we adopt mega trade deals such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. It was the choice of governments to loosen regulations on finance and aim for full cross-border capital mobility, just as it was a choice to maintain these policies largely intact, despite a massive global financial crisis. And, as the late Anthony Atkinson reminds us in his masterful book on inequality, even technological change is not immune from government agency. There is much that policymakers can do to influence the direction of technological change and ensure that it leads to higher employment and greater equity. The appeal of populists is that they give voice to the anger of the excluded. They offer a grand narrative, as well as concrete, if misleading and often dangerous, solutions. Mainstream politicians will not regain lost ground until they, too, offer serious solutions that provide room for hope. They should no longer hide behind technology or unstoppable globalization, and they must be willing to be bold and entertain large-scale reforms in the way the domestic and global economy are run. If one lesson of history is the danger of globalization running amok, another is the malleability of capitalism. It was the New Deal, the welfare state, and controlled globalization under the Bretton Woods regime that eventually gave market-oriented societies a new lease on life and produced the post-war boom. It was not tinkering and minor modification of existing policies that produced these achievements, but rather radical institutional engineering. Without bolder, bigger ideas, we may find that the good things that the present consensus produced, a liberal democratic order in particular, is swept away by the backlash wrought by its excesses. Politicians of all stripes, take note. This has been a Highbridge production, read by Sean Renette. Copyright 2018 by Danny Roderick. Published by arrangement with Danny Roderick, care of the Wiley Agency. Recording copyright 2018 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.